I do support his action of upholding the Constitution of the State of Alaska, his oath of obligation.
The Attorney General's position on same-sex marriage puts Democratic lawmakers in a tough spot. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 8th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, a little-known final chapter in the Civil War that took place in the Bering Sea.
It's a fascinating story, one that most people have never explored.
This story and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Join Alaska Public Media and participate in our statewide live online social screening and chat about the film The Home Stretch, Friday, April 17th from 12 to 1 p.m. Be part of the conversation about homeless teens in our communities. More at alaskapublic.org.
Last week, Alaska Attorney General designee Craig Richards joined 15 other states in asking the Supreme Court to uphold their bans on same-sex marriage. This comes just as legislators are deciding whether to support his confirmation in a vote later this month. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports that the action has left some Democratic lawmakers in an uncomfortable spot.
State of Alaska signs brief in support of doomed ban on marriage equality. That was the press release the Alaska Democratic Party sent on Friday, which went on to describe the Attorney General's move as embarrassing. Fast forward to a House minority press availability on Tuesday.
I do support his action of upholding the Constitution of the State of Alaska, his oath of obligation.
Democratic Minority Leader Chris Tuck told reporters that it was the duty of Attorney General designee Craig Richards to protect the state constitution, no matter what his beliefs are on a provision that bans same-sex marriage. The statement was a major shift in rhetoric from Democratic leadership. Asked three follow-up questions on the amicus brief, Tuck struggled to explain his support for the Attorney General's authority without getting into the policy the Attorney General was defending.
We want to have separation of powers from the executive branch, from the legislative branch, the judiciary branch, and we don't want to politicize the judiciary branch in any way.
The Attorney General, who is in fact part of the executive branch, is not removed from politics. Richards serves at the pleasure of the governor, and the legislature must confirm him by the session's end. And that's where the rub comes for Democrats like Tuck, who have been fairly supportive of Richards' nomination.
This is what puts us in an awkward position because many of us are very upset with the amicus brief, but at the same time, we want to support the governor and we want to have a person in there that that he can rely on.
Democratic lawmakers have been friendly toward independent Governor Bill Walker since he took office. Most of the opposition to Walker's policies and appointments has come from the right. The nomination of Craig Richards, Walker's former law partner, to the post of Attorney General has attracted special attention from Republicans who have raised questions about his work on lawsuits against the oil industry. But since Richards filed the amicus brief last week, some Democrats have expressed reservations about him. Representative Andy Josephson of Anchorage says he would like to have Richards further explain why the state should try to protect language banning same-sex marriage.
I like him personally. I don't doubt his intellectual bona fides. But there is a lot of pushback on this issue.
Some Democrats are concerned about the process as well as the policy. The issue of same-sex marriage attracted considerable attention during Walker's run for office. During the campaign, Walker criticized incumbent Republican Governor Sean Parnell for appealing a court decision favoring same-sex marriage. He argued that while he personally did not believe in it, pursuing expensive litigation that has little chance of victory is an unwise use of dwindling resources. Walker made a point to say he was not involved in the Attorney General's decision to join the brief, and even disagreed with it as a matter of policy. But Walker also said he fully respected the Attorney General's power to pursue that course of action. Senator Bill Willikowski of Anchorage says it's highly unusual for an attorney general to get that level of autonomy, if that is the case.
As long as I've been here, I've never seen an attorney general just unilaterally go out and start setting policy. And he went ahead and did it. That to me doesn't seem appropriate. That's, many people would say it's insubordination, in fact.
Willikowski says he and another Democrat in the House have asked Richards to show them precedent for the action. Willikowski says if the precedent does not exist, that could affect his view on Richards' confirmation.
When people voted for the governor, they voted with an understanding that he was not going to get involved in these sorts of issues, and I didn't want, quite frankly, an unelected bureaucrat making these decisions.
As for Tuck, he waffled some and softened his position after the press availability. He clarified that there were mixed feelings in his caucus on the action, and he wonders if it was done to shore up Republican support for Richards' confirmation.
I believe it's a political calculation for the executive branch. What we have is we have a maneuver to file the amicus brief, and it may be motivated to win some of the conservatives in the legislature for confirmation. At this point, I don't know where that plays out, but I will tell you that we do have some very upset members.
A spokesperson for the Senate's Republican majority says the action is unlikely to be a determining factor for her members. Socially conservative members of that caucus say they plan to consider Richards' record as a whole. The Department of Law did not respond to an inquiry on this matter. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Since the Murkowski administration, the Alaska House of Representatives has not passed a taxation bill where the levy goes beyond the oil industry. That changed on Wednesday when the House narrowly passed a surcharge on refined fuel. The tax amounts to 1 cent per gallon. The surcharge would replenish the state's diminished spill prevention and response fund. Right now, the fund is covered exclusively through a nickel per barrel fee tied to oil production. Juneau Republican Kathy Munoz sponsored the bill. During her floor speech, she noted the fund has been in danger for years, and delaying action on it could cause the spill prevention program to disappear.
I will be looking at a $7 million revenue shortfall in the division, and we will begin dismantling our core spill prevention and response. And that is a situation that we do not want to be in as a state.
The bill attracted a mix of opposition from legislators reluctant to instate a new tax, even at a penny. North Pole Republican Tammy Wilson slammed the bill, saying it posed a special burden to interior residents who heat their homes with refined fuel.
It is a big deal. You're making my constituents pay for something that is not our fault. And you're going to make a slush fund because of it. And we're supposed to just accept that.
As the state faces a multi-billion dollar revenue shortfall, the debate also serves as a preview of what other taxation discussions could look like. Representative Steve Thompson, a Fairbanks Republican, defended the bill, noting that it amounted to a $10 tax for a person who filled up a 20-gallon tank once a week.
We hear, why should I have to pay for this? It's not my fault. Well, sometimes we have to take responsibility and take care of things. This is health and safety and environmental protection that we have to make sure happens in our state, or we're going to have a major problem that we aren't able to take care of.
The bill passed 21-19. While Republican leadership has said it does not plan to advance a broader tax bill this session, two others have been introduced. Homer Republican Paul Seaton proposed an income tax earlier this month. On Tuesday, Fairbanks Republican Click Bishop offered a head tax to fund education, which would vary between $100 to $500 per person based on income level. Governor Bill Walker has declared a disaster in response to flooding that's making the far northern end of the Dalton Highway impassable. The road is used to supply the Prudhoe Bay oil fields. It's been closed south of Dead Horse since Sunday because of an expanding area of overflow from the Sauk River and recent blizzard conditions that have hampered Department of Transportation crews. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the disaster declaration will amp up efforts to open the road.
The state disaster declaration allows the Department of Transportation to tap additional resources and employ a streamlined procurement process to expand and speed up the Dalton Highway operation.
We need a bunch of equipment. We need additional people up there, partially because our crews that are up there now have been working pretty around the clock.
That's DOT spokeswoman Meadow Bailey, who adds that additional resources headed north immediately Wednesday.
Excavators and belly dumps and plows and just a really a wide gamut of about 16 pieces of equipment going up there right now.
The stoppage has halted tractor trailers that supply the oil industry at Prudhoe Bay. Alaska Truckers Association Executive Director Aves Thompson says the current three-plus day closure has trucking companies staging some loads along the Dalton Highway south of the closure point, but things are starting to back up.
My members tell me that there are about 700 or 800 truckloads that are in Fairbanks waiting to go to Prudhoe Bay. We're told that the fuel supplies at Prudhoe Bay are almost critically short.
Thompson credits the DOT for its work on the Dalton and helping truckers who, prior to the current shutdown, struggled through a single lane of ice and water.
DOT has been just working their hearts out, I can tell you. They've helped stranded truckers. They've pulled them out of situations where they got stuck or the brakes froze up.
Overflow has been a problem in the area before, but never to this extent. The DOT's Bailey describes a road through a braided river plain covered with ice and overflowing groundwater.
There's parts, you know, sections where it's hard to distinguish what's the road and what's the, you know, ice sheet next to it.
Bailey says hydrologists aren't sure exactly what's going on, but suspect a perfect storm of conditions have caused overflow that impacted a few miles of the road for several weeks to expand in recent days.
So what originally, you know, was maybe 5 miles we were concerned with and then 10 miles, and now we're looking at more like a 20-mile section.
It's still 0 degree cold in the area, but Bailey says there's concern breakup could make the situation worse. She says the current plan is to expand recent weeks' efforts using snow and ice to create berms to channel water off the road. She has no projection for when the impacted section of the Dalton Highway will reopen. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering one of Alaska's most loved artists.
For her, Alaska was is a place that is joyous. It's a place full of delight and joy and laughter.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying dealers throughout Alaska with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser water heaters for more than 28 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Ethan Berkowitz and Amy Dymbosky are headed to a runoff for Anchorage mayor on May 5th.
Go, Ethan, go! Go, Ethan, go!
Unofficial results show Berkowitz leading the mayoral race with 37% of the vote, but he didn't get the 45% needed to avoid a runoff. Dymbosky was the second-place candidate with about a quarter of the total votes. Berkowitz says he'll run the next part of this race the same way as the first, hard and fast.
Our strategy has always been to try and develop practical solutions to the issues that we face today and get ready for the opportunities that Anchorage has tomorrow.
Assemblymember Dymbosky beat Andrew Halcrow by about 3%. Halcrow officially conceded the race just after 11 p.m. on election night. Dymbosky was competing for a share of conservative votes against both Halcrow and Dan Coffey. She says it's helpful to now have a narrowed field.
Well, now I know who my opponent is directly, so there will definitely be compare-contrast opportunities.
The biggest surprise for election watchers was the low return for Coffey, who has been campaigning since 2013 and outspent every other candidate by a wide margin. Coffey received just 14% of the vote. The school board races were decisive. Incumbent Kathleen Plunkett had twice the number of votes as Derek Slaughter to retain seat E. Incumbent Tam Augusti-Giesler beat David Neese for seat F. And Elisa Snelling overtook Star Marcet to secure the seat being vacated by Natasha von Imhoff. All but one of the bond proposals passed. The capital improvements bond for upgrades to the Chester Creek Sports Complex failed. The contentious school bond secured 53% of the vote. As the legislative statute currently stands, about 60% of the $59 million bond will be reimbursed by the state. 150 years ago this week, tomorrow actually, General Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox, Virginia. Textbooks typically say this event signaled the end of the Civil War, but a few historians make the case that the last shots of the war were actually fired from a Confederate ship off of Alaska's coast in the Bering Sea. APRN's Liz Ruskin has this tale of forgotten history.
The CSS Shenandoah was one of a handful of Confederate commerce raiders commissioned to bruise the Union economy by ruining the U.S. shipping industry. The Shenandoah continued its destructive mission until the summer of 1865, nearly 3 months after Appomattox. Sam Craighead of the American Civil War Museum in Richmond, Virginia, has studied its strange story and its last acts of aggression near the Arctic Circle.
Well, you can't really call it the last shots of the Civil War because there was only one side that loosed a blank cartridge in capturing a whaling ship in the Bering Sea.
The Shenandoah was a 230-foot ship with both sails and a steam engine. She seized dozens of commercial vessels, often without firepower, though Craighead says the crew burned many to the waterline and forced others to transport prisoners.
So they destroyed the enemy's ships, and that is perfectly legitimate under naval warfare.
It sounds brutal, but Craighead isn't one to judge Captain James Waddell harshly.
The Shenandoah captured 1,053 sailors. Not a one was harmed. They were all sent to a friendly port on a ship that he bonded.
By 1865, U.S. cargo ships were scarce. All the raiding and burning scared off customers and drove insurance rates sky high. So the Shenandoah chased the Yankee whaling fleet in the Pacific. In the Caroline Islands, Micronesia, Waddell burned four whaling ships he found in the harbor. But first, he took their nautical charts, revealing the Arctic whaling grounds. By then, Craighead says it was early April.
That's 4 days after Lee surrendered at Appomattox. But if you have any idea where the Caroline Islands are, that's out in the middle of nowhere. They might as well have been on the other side of the moon, because they had no information.
How long they remained uninformed would later be in dispute. In any case, in June, the Confederate raiders were north of the Aleutian Chain. Here, Craighead says they destroyed one ship after another.
All right, on the 25th, near St. Lawrence Island, they captured the whale ship General Williams. On the 26th, near the same place, the William C. Nye, the Catherine, and the Nimrod.
At one point, Craighead says, the Shenandoah had 200 captives on board and a string of a dozen small open boats taken from the whaling ships.
And they put those 200 men in those 12 whale boats and tied them end to end and then hooked them to the Shenandoah and pulled them along.
They destroyed ship after ship until June 28, when they hit the jackpot near the Bering Strait. A whaler had crashed into ice and was totaled. Other ships had gathered for an auction of its valuable whale oil and bone. The Shenandoah, Craighead says, took them all.
Besides the Brunswick, they burned the Congress, Covington, Favorite, Hillman, Isaac Howland, Martha Second, Nassau, and Waverly.
They left two whaling ships intact to carry prisoners. Craighead says one had the captain's wife and children on board.
This captain had died during the voyage, and they preserved his body in a barrel of whiskey to take it back to New England.
Finally, on August 2nd, after sailing south to ice-free waters, the Shenandoah came across a ship with a newspaper that said the South had surrendered, President Lincoln was dead, and the war was over. Only then did the crew of the Shenandoah give up the mission. Now, some historians, like U.S. authorities back in the day, say the men of the Shenandoah acted as pirates in the Bering Sea because they knew by then the war was over. Their prisoners told them. Captain Waddell, though, claimed he had no proof. Yes, one ship had a newspaper that told of the surrender, but that paper also said the Confederate president had vowed to fight on. Craighead believes the captain. Regardless, Craighead says he wishes more people knew the tale.
It's a fascinating story. one that most people have never explored. We spend so much time with Grant and Lee and Jackson that we don't get into what happened in the Navy.
As for the captain and crew of the Shenandoah, they sailed on to England and escaped prosecution. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. The Homestretch premieres on Alaska Public Media Monday, April 13th at 9 p.m., a film about three homeless teens braving Chicago winters, high school pressures, and life on the streets to build a brighter future. Following the film on Friday, April 17th from 12 to 1 p.m., will be a statewide online conversation and chat simultaneously engaging with panelists and community members about this film and homeless teens. Details at alaskapublic.org.
It took a few years and an act of Congress, but today the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced rural subsistence hunters don't need to purchase federal duck stamps. Myra Nanig, head of the Association of Village Council Presidents, says many thought this was included in the Migratory Bird Treaty in the 1990s, which allowed spring and summer subsistence hunts.
We assumed that Alaska Natives would have duck stamp exemption with the acceptance of the treaty. And at that time, the solicitor who lived here in Anchor said that's not included.
For years, it was unclear whether village hunters had to buy the $15 annual duck stamps. Changing the law was a big priority for Alaska Native advocates and for Alaska Congressman Don Young. Young heralded the announcement of the new federal enforcement rules with a videotaped statement and his own duck call. Young called it a major victory for rural Alaska.
Remember, we had this problem before. Who had a stamp? Who didn't have a stamp? This solves the problem. So I'm real pleased with Fish and Wildlife, and I'm pleased with being able to get this law passed through the Congress.
The new rule exempts rural hunters who are permanent residents of subsistence harvest areas from buying the stamp, though they must still comply with other state and federal hunting laws. A new federal law raises the duck stamp fee to $25. Beloved artist Ree Munoz passed away Monday night at Bartlett Regional Hospital in Juneau after a stroke. She was 93. Munoz was active until the end, a prolific artist and traveler who drew inspiration from everyday Alaskans. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Ree Munoz was born in Southern California in 1921 as Marie Munier. Her parents were from Holland, and she spent a lot of her childhood there, where Ree was a common nickname. Daughter-in-law Kathy Munoz says as a teenager, Ree and her two brothers were separated from their parents for 4 years. They were on a boat to the United States, and their parents were supposed to meet up with them 1 week later. But World War II broke out.
It was her brothers and her that went on to California, and on their own, they took care of themselves. They got odd jobs. They got a place to stay. After she graduated from high school, then she was reunited with her parents.
She moved to Juneau in 1950, traveling by steamship up the Inside Passage. In 1951, she and newlywed husband Juan Munoz Sr. went to teach on King Island, located in the Bering Sea near Nome. King Island Christmas is based on her time there. Munoz illustrated the children's book, and the late Gene Rogers wrote it. After their time on King Island, Munoz and her husband later divorced, and she raised their son Juan, again Kathy Munoz.
When he was young, they were often on the road in the summertime. They would load up her van with artwork, and they would travel to remote communities, and they did what was called a series of clothespin art shows, where they would come into a community and string a line and then hang her paintings for sale.
That built up her following and reputation as an artist. After holding a number of jobs like teacher, journalist, and curator at the Alaska State Museum, Munoz started making a living as an artist in 1972. Kes Woodward is an artist, art historian, and teacher. He met Munoz in 1977 when he moved to Juneau to be the State Museum curator. He said Munoz considered her work impressionistic. She was known for her watercolors of Alaska scenes, such as fishermen at work, children at play, and life in remote villages. He says Munoz was the most widely traveled Alaskan artist, and her art focused on Alaskan people.
She depicted them enjoying themselves. For her, Alaska is a place that is joyous. It's a place full of delight and joy and laughter. And I think that's her real legacy, is that she captured that better than anybody else, better than anybody ever has.
Munoz described her process in 1985.
The subjects that I like to paint are people doing things. Now, that doesn't mean somebody sitting in an office typing, you know, but people doing things that appeal to me, such as working outside in any sort of occupation mostly. And I go to many, many places to sketch and then come back with those sketches and do the paintings from those sketches.
Munoz was speaking in a KTOO TV series, Conversations. At the time, she says she was painting up to 85 original works a year.
I think that art should be creative and honest. And by creative, I mean just that, you know, you have to create something out of yourself. As far as the honesty is concerned, I think that an artist should paint exactly what he or she wants to paint and not ask him or herself, what if I paint this, will this sell? It just doesn't work that way.
Her work has been exhibited in numerous museums and galleries in Alaska, Seattle, and elsewhere in North America. Her work is also in many homes.
Well, I find my art in a lot of bathrooms. And one reason I do is because I've done a number of nudes, and of course, they're perfect in a bathroom.
Munoz's death was unexpected. She was at Easter brunch on Sunday. On Friday night, she went to her granddaughter's first solo art show. As her granddaughter was growing up, they used to spend hours together, sitting side by side, painting and sketching. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The University of Alaska Southeast School of Management offers online college degrees for the unconventional student or working professional who wants learning on their schedule and timeline. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS. Alaska Pacific University emphasizes teaching and research that engages the region's social, cultural, environmental, and geopolitical issues. The university's Early Honors Program attracts academically advanced high school students who complete their senior year credits while also earning college credits as full-time APU students. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.